From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Nellie's Ghost. At the topmost tip of Maine, the first American highway begins. Highway 1 continues down the northeast side of the state until it reaches the sea, and there it soon comes to the town of Machias and its nearby village of Machiasport. It was right in this area that the first recorded American ghost appeared. Nellie Butler was not, of course, the earliest phantom in this country, but she was the first to be written up and substantiated with sworn testimonies. This is what makes her truly unique, that over 100 observers declared themselves to have either seen or heard her. Perhaps the most significant of all her firsts is that she was witnessed by more people than any other ghost before or since. It was on the night of August 9, 1799, in the house of Mr. Abner Blaisdell, on the coast near Machiasport, that a disembodied voice was heard announcing that its owner was going to appear in the village. Abner Blaisdell was a man of piety and upright character, and he wished to retain that reputation, so the members of his family were told to keep to themselves the story of the strange voice from out of nowhere. They well knew the ridicule with which such a tale would be met by their practical, God-fearing, seafaring neighbors. As time passed and the sound did not come again, the Blaisdells finally decided that they had let themselves be fooled by the whispering wind, and they forgot about the whole affair. But 5 months later, on January 2nd, 1800, the voice was heard again in the house. It was obviously a woman speaking, and she told her listeners she was Captain George Butler's deceased wife, who, they well knew, had been David Hooper's daughter, Nellie. She ordered them to send 2 messengers straight away to fetch her father. The disembodied voice had a very authoritative sound. No one dared refuse to do its bidding, so David Hooper was sent for. Wondering, ridiculing, and grumbling at the foolishness, the old man made the 6-mile trip. But when he heard the very tone and manner of his daughter's voice speaking to him, he became convinced that he was actually listening to her departed spirit. When he wrote his affidavit about this and subsequent experiences, he stated that she gave such clear and irresistible tokens of her being the spirit of my own daughter as gave me no less satisfaction than admiration and delight. The admiration and delight were never to come to the Blaisdells, however. They always felt very put upon at being the chosen subjects for the visitations. Nellie Butler even made her first appearance to one of them, Captain Paul Blaisdell, Abner's son. Captain Paul was walking through a field one day in late January 1800 when he saw an unreal-looking figure of a woman in the distance. In a few moments, she had moved rapidly toward him. She had never touched the ground, he said in his affidavit, but had seemed to float just above it. Her raiment, he said, was as white as possible. He was literally dumbfounded by the apparition and could say nothing to it before it vanished. The next evening, the specter, as Nellie was afterward called, appeared at Abner's house again and rebuked Paul for not speaking to her, an old friend and neighbor in the field. After this visitation, to the vast relief of the family, there was a respite from her attentions. In March, however, Mrs. Butler returned, and chatted for 2 hours with the four Blaisdells, whom she insisted must go down into the cellar for the interview. It was frightening to be sitting in the dark cellar, talking to an invisible entity, but no one had the nerve to resist her demands. She told them that though my body is consumed and turned to dust, my soul is as much alive as before I left the body. She always spoke in religious terms and usually began with many hallelujahs. One might almost suspect that Nelly had the soul of an evangelist and was enjoying her revival in more ways than one. A whole month passed before she came again, but in May she was back for 6 one-night stands. From then on, the entire countryside was agog with gossip, innuendo, and questions. Was she, or wasn't she, the deceased spirit she claimed to be? And if not, what was she? By now, her manifestations had become visible to some people, although others still only heard her. Among the latter, some heard her words distinctly. A few heard a strange voice but could not understand the words spoken. Some persons who were unable at first to see the specter succeeded in doing so after repeated visits. A few poor, unfavored individuals could neither see nor hear her, and they quite naturally suspected their neighbor's sanity. Yet of those who testified as to the evidence they had received of her existence, most could both see and hear her, and she was usually in a shining white garment. All to whom she appeared agreed that the form and features were those of the deceased woman she claimed to be, and they all testified to the bright light which came from her, so that it illuminated a field at night and shone like a lamp in the cellar. A typical description of the order of events at these seances was given by a stranger to the district, Mary Gordon, who came to Messiahsport out of great curiosity. Mary stayed at the Blaisdell home on the night of August 4th. Apparently this poor family had to keep open house all the time, for if they turned anybody away, it would have been claimed that they did not want their fraud to be detected. Mary Gordon said that about 2 hours before daylight, there was a barrage of loud knocks that awakened everybody. It was the regular procedure of the ghost to announce her coming by a series of knocks, and so hastily dressing, Mary went downstairs. There she joined the rest of the assembly, most of whom must have slept on the floor, for they numbered about 20, and they all trooped down to the cellar, which by this time was known to be the specter's favorite spot. Then, writes Mary, I heard such a voice speaking to us as I never heard before nor since. It was shrill, but mild and pleasant. Mr. Blaisdell, in addressing the voice, said that several persons, of whom I was one, had come from a distance to obtain satisfaction and desired that she would tell us who she was and the design of her coming. She answered, I was once N.H., and after I was married, I was N.B. After much conversation upon the design of her coming, she appeared to us. At first, the apparition was a mere mass of light, then grew into personal form about as tall as myself. We stood in two ranks, about 4 or 5 feet apart. Between these ranks, she slowly passed and repassed so that any of us could have handled her. When she passed by me, her nearness was that of contact, so that if there had been a substance, I should have certainly felt it. The glow of the apparition had a constant tremulous motion. At last, the personal form became shapeless, expanded every way, and then vanished in a moment. Everyone at the Blaisdells was at first so frightened of the specter that the children had moved their beds into their parents' room. Nellie did not like to be an object of fear, and that may be why she usually held her meetings in the cellar, away from the family rooms. A medium would say that the cellar made an excellent seance room because the power to manifest could be built up more strongly in a confined dark space. Whatever her reason, Mrs. Butler tried to pacify the Blaisdell children. She said, Be not afraid. You need not be. I never hurt you, did I? And I shall not hurt you now. Put your things in place. And so the children took her at her word and moved back into their own room, and it is true she never did anything to harm them. In the area at this time lived a most deserving minister, Abraham Cummings. He was a well-educated man, a graduate of Brown University, but he was also unworldly enough never to worry about food, shelter, or raiment. Apparently his faith was justified, because in 1793, when he had been a supply pastor for a congregational church in Bath, Maine, his parishioners had presented him with a sailboat. From then on, he conducted most of his ministry from his boat, cruising along the coast and going ashore to preach in the small settlements, among the islands, and on the mainland. When he reached Machias, he heard about the famous specter, and he was shocked, badly shocked. Those congregations were simple folk. He had certainly thought they were of a higher intellectual level than to take such ungodly supernatural stories seriously. He contemplated giving them a resounding sermon on the fallacies of blind superstition. During June, while he was in Machias Port, there were no reports of visits from the specter, and the Reverend Mr. Cummings credited his presence with keeping the irrational element of his flock in line. Then one evening in July, some excited people ran to him saying that the specter had returned. What should he do about it? He wondered. He paced the floor for a time, trying to decide how to best to cope with the situation. Finally, his curiosity got the better of him. He left his home and walked out to see for himself. Crossing the open field in front of his house, the preacher noticed a slight knoll or rise in the ground about 200 feet ahead of him. There he could see a group of white rocks on the slopes, showing dimly against the dark turf. Probably something such as that is all the ghosts amount to, he thought, as he kept walking towards the knoll. But when he looked up 2 or 3 minutes later, his jaw dropped perceptibly. One of those white rocks had risen off the ground and was now taking the shape of a globe of light with a rosy tinge. He turned directly toward the amazing spectacle so that he could examine it closely. As he walked forward, he kept his eyes fixed on this light for fear it might disappear. But he had not gone more than 5 paces when the glowing mass flashed right to where he was. Instantly, the light resolved itself into the shape of a woman. Her size was abnormally small, however, perhaps that of a child of 7. Staring at her in amazement, the parson thought, "You're not tall enough for the woman who has been appearing among us." Immediately, the figure expanded to normal size, and he rode afterward. She appeared glorious, with rays of light shining from her head, like a halo extending clear to the ground. Cummings, not being conversant with the etiquette of ghostly circles, just stared. He seemed to remember having read somewhere that if one ever met an apparition, he must let it speak first, so he politely kept silent. All the while, as he gazed at the vision, he was filled with 2 strangely conflicting emotions. One, he says, was genuine fright. But, he adds in his account of his experience, my fear was connected with ineffable pleasure. In another moment, the specter was gone, but the influence of that radiant apparition never left the Reverend Mr. Cummings for the rest of his life. After that, he says, all mundane things seemed dull and commonplace, and of no real value. Gone now was his amused contempt for the ignorant yokels who had been taken in by ghost stories. He had seen for himself. He believed, and he was the kind of man who would try to do something about it. From that time forward, he investigated every instance of the specter's appearance, about which he heard, and talked with every witness. He it was who later published the account of all the strange happenings, accompanied by the testimony of every beholder he could contact. An edition of his pamphlet that is still in existence, a copy of it is at Brown University, was published in Bath in 1826, the year before Abraham Cummings' death. Another edition was issued in Portland in 1859, and of it there are 3 copies extant. Unfortunately, Cummings told his story very badly in these pamphlets. He may have been brilliant in the pulpit, but on paper he is tedious and dull, wasting many pages in theological argument to prove that ghostly communications are not contrary to Holy Writ. Cummings was no journalist. He tantalized rather than reported, managing, when he finally got to the plot of his story, to leave out even an important detail as the location of the events. He supposed that everyone knew where it had happened. After all, by the time Cummings wrote up the case, the specter had been the cause célèbre of the Maine coast for 26 years. It is only incidentally that one learns the full names of the main characters in Cummings' pamphlet. You have to figure out from the affidavits, for instance, which Blaisdell was Nellie's host. Everyone testifying to the apparition was extremely reluctant to mention first names. Even the ghost is called N. Butler, or N.B., all the way through, and it is only Mary Bragdon, the next to last witness in the book, who states that the spirit told us she was once Nellie Butler. Abraham Cummings said his desire was to present to the public a complete satisfactory analysis of this whole mystery, and he does anything else but that. Still, his motives were good. His effort was made primarily because of the unfortunate charges that had been laid against the Blaisdells, and he wished his evidence to exonerate them of the persistent implications of fraud, which arose largely from the fact that the specter had given orders for her husband, Captain George Butler, to marry one of Abner Blaisdell's daughters, Lydia. Lydia and George had been eyeing one another favorably for some time previously, and maybe Nellie thought she would help a good cause along, which just goes to show that death does not give one infallibility, or perhaps that even a ghostly finger in the pie can be one too many. Abner Blaisdell was determined that the match should not take place, and as soon as the specter started pushing it, so was Lydia. "No, sir," she protested indignantly, if tearfully, "I will not do it." "Why not?" asked Captain Butler with a man's innocence in such matters. "I will not marry a man who has been scared into proposing by a ghost. And that's all there is to it," Lydia was adamant at the time. Captain Butler was not at first too insistent. He could hardly have been eager to indulge in the intimacies of the bedchamber with a new wife while his old wife was still so obviously hovering about and so interested in his affairs. And yet, why should he let a former spouse's espousal of his cause keep him from his happiness? And so at length, as Cummings says, Captain Butler's unreserved and honorable confession and his renewed assurances that his own will was his as well as that of his deceased wife did with the words of the specter prevail. When the marriage plans were made public, the gossip started in earnest. Lydia was said was obviously somehow dressing up and appearing as a specter and using a sounding board of some kind to produce the voices, all just in order to get a husband. The girl gave up. Worn out by unjust reproaches abroad and these vexations at home, Abraham Cummings writes, she at last told Captain Butler, offering him a golden token of her constant affection, that she could bear these miseries no longer, and that they must separate. He pleaded the impropriety of her conduct of such as evidence that the appointment was divine. His plea was the waste of words. She dismissed him utterly and forever. This I had by the favor of Captain Butler himself. Lydia next tried to sail off in a vessel that had come into port. Bound and determined to get away, she thought she would visit relatives about 200 miles down the coast. But the miraculous voice solemnly warned her in the hearing of several witnesses that her efforts were in vain and that her afflictions would sail with her. So once again, Captain Butler was sent for, and this time he stubbornly refused to allow anybody, visible or invisible, to mess things up for him. The nuptials were celebrated shortly afterward. Oddly enough, within 24 hours of the wedding, the specter came to Captain Butler and whispered, "Be kind to Lydia, for she will not be with you long. She will have one child and die within the year." This came to pass as predicted. 10 months afterward, Lydia gave birth to a child and died the next day. One is inclined to wonder if the first Mrs. Butler's meddling in her husband's affairs might have been more malicious than anyone realized, intended to make sure that he would marry someone who would not outlive her in his affections. But perhaps this is to malign a pure spirit. Nellie knew that from the moment of the wedding the gossip would increase, and it did. On one occasion, she told a large crowd of people that on account of her visits to this house, the Blaisdell family had been subjected to cruel and wicked gossip and false accusations, and she predicted that these would grow even worse. It must be said that she did make several efforts to clear Lydia of the charges of fraud that she had been responsible for causing. Once, when she had a sizable audience in the Blaisdell cellar, the specter ordered Lydia to go upstairs, attended by two women, and sit on the hearth in one of the rooms. Then the star performer carried on triumphantly in the cellar, proving that what she said could not possibly have been the work of Lydia and a sounding board or ventriloquism or anything else. Another time, she had all the people assembled get up and go for a hike. They marched in a procession at her command, two by two in a solemn step, as at a funeral, trudging a matter of a couple of miles and back. The Wraith herself brought up the end of the procession, marching it as the partner of the highly unwilling Lydia Butler, who had never yet been able to muster up much affection for her husband's first wife. Much to Lydia's dismay, on this occasion Nellie floated alongside her all the way. This was done apparently for one reason only, that all the people should see Nellie with Lydia and know that the two could not possibly, by any trick or fraud, be one. Even when they saw the phenomenon of her appearance or heard her voice, some of the people of the community did not believe they were witnessing the actual ghost of Mrs. Butler. They had recourse to only one other theory to explain the apparition, but it seemed logical to them. They believed that this wraith of a dead woman must be fashioned by the devil. This was the position taken by Nellie's sister, Mrs. Sally Wentworth, although her parents were quite convinced to the contrary. The austere Mrs. Wentworth's testimony may be more illuminating of her character and disposition than she realized. She writes, August 8th, I was there with about 30 others and heard much conversation. Her voice was still hoarse and thick like that of my sister on her deathbed, but more hollow. Sometimes it was clear and always pleasant. A certain person did, in my opinion, very unwisely, ask her whether I was a true Christian. The reply was, she thinks she is, she thinks she is, she is my sister. Mrs. Wentworth says she was for a time convinced it was Nellie speaking, especially when a private conversation was reported to her, which she and her sister had held, and which had never been revealed to another soul. But she wonders, could not some evil spirit hear that conversation and afterwards personate my sister and reveal it? If it was easier for Mrs. Wentworth to believe that an evil spirit could exist and impersonate Nellie than that her own sister could return from the grave, others were more readily convinced that the specter's claims were true. Among these was Captain George Butler, who had been satisfied of the ghost's identity almost from the start. Captain Butler writes, when I was called to talk with this voice, I asked, who are you? It answered, I was once your wife. The voice asked me, do you not remember what I told you when I was alive? I answered, I do not really know what you mean. The voice said, do you not remember I told you I did not think I should live long with you? I told you that if you were to leave me, I should never wish to change my condition, but that if I were to leave you, I could not blame you if you did. This passed between me and my first wife while she was alive, and there was no living person within hearing but she and myself, and I'm sure that this was never revealed to any person, and no living person could have told it to me before the voice did. As Lydia and I stood side and side alone, a little distance from the rest of the company, She had her left arm around me and her right hand hold of the forward part of my waistcoat, her head leaning against my breast. There was something appeared to my view right before me, like a person in a winding sheet, and her arms folded under the winding sheet, and on her arm there appeared to be a very small child. By this appearance, I did not know possibly, but I might be deceived. I reached out my left hand to take hold of it. I saw my hand in the middle of it, but could feel nothing. That same evening it appeared and disappeared to me 3 times. The testimony of George Butler was corroborated by 4 other people who said that on that occasion they had seen the same thing he had described. Apparently the reason that Nellie held a baby when she appeared to her husband was because she had died in childbirth, as Lydia was also destined to do. For some strange reason, the specter insisted upon having her infant's body exhumed and reburied in another spot about 30 feet away. Cummings is at his most nebulous when he states, "There seemed no reason for doing this at the time. It was ordered about 18 months later. Its purpose was understood." He leaves his readers' curiosity forever unsatisfied on this score. Besides her orders to have certain unaccountable acts performed, the ghost of Mrs. Butler was also famous for her extrasensory perceptions. She foretold a legal suit involving the Blaisdells, evidently one growing out of the gossip over this affair, and just how it would result. Again, on one of her earliest visits, Abner Blaisdell asked her about his father, who he had heard was sick. York, Maine, where his father had lived, was 200 miles away, and news traveled slowly in those days. The specter promptly answered that his father was dead. Blaisdell later learned that his father had truly died 7 days before. Nellie was quite a ham, and she enjoyed her role and the notoriety she was receiving. She was always declaiming, besides her hallelujahs, such phrases as, "I am the voice crying in the wilderness," and "I am from above praising God and the Lamb." Some of her listeners were surprised because in life she had never been known for her devoutness. Abner Blaisdell, describing some of her Christian declarations, says, "I then spake to her myself and said, 'I never knew that you experienced a change of nature before you died, and I should be glad if you would tell me when you experienced it.' 'It was,' said she, 'when I laid upon my deathbed.' Then she spake to her parents and reminded them of the conversation which had passed between them at that time, respecting the loss of her child. 'Then it was,' said she, 'that I received my change.' Her parents joyfully confirmed her statement." A concluding testimony, chosen from among the dozens quoted by Cummings, shows how another man who at first completely disbelieved in the phenomenon later wrote of his experiences. Mr. Paul Simpson, Jr. submits, August 9, 1800. "I was at Mr. A. Blaisdell's with many more and heard the sound of knocking. It was addressed, and a voice answered, but I could not understand it. Several persons spoke, but received no satisfactory answer. The people generally concluded that the whole affair was some deception. Therefore they went off, and I among them. But my reflections on the singular knocking induced me to say to 2 young men, "If you go back, I will, and find out something more if possible, for I am no more satisfied now than I was before I went to that house." We went back. Mr. Blaisdell asked us why we returned. I told him that we had gone off with the opinion that the whole affair was a scheme contrived by his daughters, and nothing more, and I meant, if possible, to find them out. "You must think as you please," said he. "I am clear, and I believe my family is." I told him I wished to see all his family sitting in one part of the room. They complied. Then I took a candle and stood in the midst of the room. After several minutes, something rapped near where 2 of us stood, and from thence removed to several parts of the house. "What do you think of it?" said Mr. Blaisdell. "It appears," said I, "to be strange." "We will go into the cellar," said Mr. Blaisdell, "and if you think anybody is there, search the cellar through with a candle." We did so. I came out last and was careful and watched. so that I was sure that no person went down. Also, the outer door was fast. Then again we heard the sound of knocking. It was addressed and conversation followed, in the midst of which Mr. Blaisdell said to me, "If you think any living person talks, go forward and grasp that person." I went forward a few steps, but was so convinced that nobody was there that I considered all further attempts as useless. After much discourse, which I cannot remember, the spirit told us that we must go up and come down again in order, two and two, and she would appear to us. We did so, and I saw the apparition at first about 2 feet in height, but as it drew nearer to me, it appeared as tall as a person. I saw this appearance pass close by me and from me 5 or 6 times. At last it diminished to about 1 foot in height and then vanished. Well, what are we to make of all this? Was a whole community suddenly mass hypnotized? Was the preacher's pamphlet a hoax? And if so, why? Certainly Cummings' contemporaries accepted it as an honest tale. And most certainly a few old-timers in that part of Maine still refer to the Messiah's ghost as something that has been handed down to them by tradition. Why don't we just take the whole tale at face value then? In that case, the story is simply this. A deceased woman made herself evident to the people of her community for over a year and then disappeared again forever. What possibly could have been her object? Cummings thinks it was to try to prove the truth of immortality. Whatever her reasons, we have to admit that this is not only the first recorded ghost story of our country, but also quite the most remarkable.